Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Well, Dr. Bradshaw, now that we've talked a bit about your early years and your time as a missionary and as a mission president, I'd love to turn our discussion a bit to your time as a professor at BYU. I can't imagine feeling more fondly about my experiences at BYU in terms of how rigorous I felt like the academics were, the quality of the professors that I had, and specifically my experiences in the honors program, taking honors religion classes from you, and my honors colloquium classes with Ted Lyon, who I've interviewed for this podcast, and others. So I want to touch on that a bit before we talk about some other things. But before that, maybe share some stories or reflections on going back from your mission to teach at BYU and what it was like leading up to those Holland and then Haven years.
Biology at BYU, as you know, is housed in the Widso building. And my tenure at BYU coincides with that building. So my first year here in 1970 was the year that building was opened for business. And a new building has been approved, and the Widso building is coming down in a year or so.
That's the one with the pendulum in it?
No, that's the I-ring science building.
Sorry.
For physical science and chemistry and geology. Biological-related disciplines are in the Widso building. So when I first came, I joined the zoology department. Before that, it had been entomology and zoology. And when I told a friend that I was coming to BYU, he said, well, you know, the biologists at BYU all count insects' legs, and they're all looking to find something more than six, but they've never succeeded. A sort of sarcastic commentary on classical descriptive biology, cataloging of the things, the living things of the world. So my training is in biochemistry. I taught the first cell biology course, biology at the level of cells and molecules that had been taught at the university. Our college has gone through reinvention and reorganization, and I ended as a member of the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Biology. Well, I have found students at BYU to be, in general, dedicated, interested, competent students. I would say that they share with students throughout the country the sort of unfortunate background of being accustomed almost entirely to an academic program of memorize, do well on multiple choice sorts of examinations, and the lifespan, the half-life of that kind of education isn't very great. And that's an oversimplification, and there are very important exceptions to it. But From the beginning, I have been interested in how one might improve the ability of students to think analytically, to problem solve, and to practice science intellectually, as well as introduce the practice of science in the laboratory to the extent that that's possible. It's difficult to do that in a very extensive fashion because it's very very money intensive. One of the interesting experience I had was the period of time when I served as an associate dean of the honors program. And encountered some of the diversity of opinion that exists in the BYU community about what the real function of the university ought to be. And I have always held to the sort of idealistic vision of a university in the liberal arts tradition. Yes, a university education ought to prepare a person for a secure future. Yes, it's important to leave a major with sufficient information so that one can be employable and find secure work. But all of this against the more important broad background of being informed, learning how to use one's mind, participating in the life of the mind in ways that are not going to be possible again when you leave the university. Life closes in pretty fast, and there's car payments, and there's children, and runny noses, and colds, and paying mortgages, and all the rest of it. And the university years are uniquely free and open for exploring who one is and what the world is and what you can make of it. And that's always been an important vision of school for me. One anecdote. I served for a while under D. Lamar Jensen, a professor of history, and later under Jim Curl, professor of economics. And when Jim was dean, we provided a meeting for incoming freshmen and their parents and families, a matriculation event. It was held in the Marriott Center. Those of us participating on the program wore academic regalia. We honored those coming in. Jim gave a great talk, and it featured books. It featured wonderful illustrations of extraordinary books, medieval tomes with these illuminations, these wonderful colored, hand-drawn pictures. You know, and I think everybody's thinking, wow, Harvard's Widener Library, the Library of Congress. He shows a number of these, and then at the end says, and you know what? All of these are in the Harold Bealey Library at BYU. And the library is a great place, and books are wonderful, and we're so pleased that you're here to enter into the life of the mind, and so go out there and enjoy BYU and its opportunities for intellectual growth. That meeting had a lifetime of one session, never held again. And there were voices at the university who were not pleased with it. In its place, they would have had a meeting that emphasized spirituality, religious commitment. I don't disagree at all with spirituality or religious commitment, but the university is a place where one develops the ability to think well, and at BYU in the context of our commitment to the gospel. During about a 10-year period of time, from maybe 1985 to 95, roughly, I taught Biology 100, the university general education required course for non-majors. It met in the Joseph Smith Building, old and new, a large auditorium.
900 students at a time?
Sometimes. Sometimes three of those in a semester. When someone hears that, it's automatic to think, oh, what a terrible experience that must have been. An impersonal, large enrollment experience where students are numbers and nobody knows your name. Well, of course, that's the challenge, but we tried hard to eliminate or reduce the negative aspects of that. So I love to roam up and down the aisles, to wedge myself in between students' knees and walk along an aisle and encounter people on a one-to-one basis and carry a microphone and have an exchange. And it was important, I thought, in that course to deal with the big conceptual issues in biology. We had four of them. And in each of those four divisions of the course, we concluded with at least two class periods devoted to gospel-related or social-related or ethical-related issues. So in the section on embryology and cells, we talked about issues like in vitro fertilization. The third of the four sections was biological evolution. Evolution is the foundational principle for biology. If you choose to teach biology in the absence of reference to evolution, you missed the point. And I can't tell you how many people would say to me, well, do you teach evolution at BYU? And so we don't need to sort of rehearse the background for the fact that in our culture, this has been a controversial issue. Not unique to us, but it's certainly there in the history of Mormon thought. Well, the issue could arouse strong emotions. I remember in the Joseph Smith Auditorium having students stand up, waving the little blue booklet from Brother Bankhead of the religion department and denounce what I was saying in my attempts to persuade students that our religious faith and our understanding of the science were compatible, and that one need not fear the science. And more than that, evolution is one of the extraordinarily interesting, provocative, lovely ideas that mankind has arrived at. I hold Darwin in great reverence. What a wonderful, thoughtful, sensitive, brilliant, insightful man. As an aside, for 10 or 15 years, every semester and once a year at least, every other semester, sometimes twice a year, usually in October in the fall semester, I found an evening when there was a room free. I put up posters saying I was going to talk about LDS theology and biological evolution, invited anybody to come, and if they wanted to hear my two bits worth, which was a totally positive, brief look into why evolution is a great idea and why it fits with my own vision of religious principles. It turns out that one of the sad experiences of my tenure at BYU was when I was blackballed by the College of Religion for continuing to teach religious classes. So, John, this would have been a period shortly after you and I were studying together. And The circumstance was that a talk was given in a all BYU stake fireside on a Sunday evening by Elder Packer. It was part of a Book of Mormon symposium celebration, and for reasons not clear to me, Elder Packer chose to focus on the issue of evolution in his talk. And he gave a pretty strongly worded, unequivocal denunciation. Well, that was Sunday night. Monday morning at 9, I'm back in the Joseph Smith Auditorium with three sections of 700 people, and the hands start going up before the bell rings. And some of the students' responses were sarcastic and uncivil. Well, Dr. Bradshaw and Dr. Barnes, I guess that puts you in your place, doesn't it? Now, that there were only a few who responded in that way. But some students, we were in the middle of our evolution section. Some of the students got up and walked out in the middle of the hour. Subsequent to that, when I was no longer part of the administration of the honors and general education programs, I received a memo from Dean Millett saying that I would no longer be approved to teach religion courses. John, over the course of 10 years, I tried without success to talk to Brother Millett personally about this. In fact, I asked three deans of religious education if they would try to mediate a conversation. And Bob would not agree to this. Subsequently, I found out from Dean Robert Matthews that some student in the class at this time had come to the Dean of Religion complaining that Brother Bradshaw had borne testimony in class on a certain day that he knew that what Brother Packer had said in the fireside was not true. John, I never said anything like that. I don't believe that. I'm not so politically inept to have said it. Had I believed it, I don't believe it. But on the basis of that, I was designated as persona non grata and was not allowed to teach. Apart from the personal unhappiness that that caused for me and my family, that's not the way for people of goodwill to behave to one another. It's not the way that Latter-day Saints are taught to behave toward one another in the face of some disagreement. But unfortunately, it's not an isolated incident on our campus when agreements of this sort are not faced openly and with candor and with sensitivity, but someone with an axe to grind makes some sort of an end run to some person in authority, and then events of this sort take place. One correction, John. It was a rat, not a mouse, whose head I cut off that day in class when we removed the liver and isolated DNA, and then on another animal subsequently delivered a litter of rat pups caesarean. But I wanted students in the course to understand, for example, in the context of extreme controversy over using laboratory animals, which controversy was just beginning at the time we were in class together, but has grown even larger since, that there's an issue about how one answers questions. I tried to make the case that the appropriate use of animals was justified and provide examples of what important advances in medicine and other related fields have come from those kinds of experiments. And at the same time, to make it clear that there are guidelines and there are policies that that are based on ethical principles, and that there are issues like this in the world, and they deserve our attention and they deserve our thoughtfulness, and that's part of what we're trying to teach at BYU. One other example, and I won't remember the date with precision, but a wonderful sculpture exhibit came to BYU. The work of Rodin, and there were a number of pieces. Earlier, I had seen the Rodin Garden at Stanford. It's an outdoor patio, a lovely place, and there are pieces by Rodin there, and it's just the right sort of thing for a university to provide for students and staff and faculty and members of the community. Rodin exhibit came to BYU. Two of the pieces suffered the same fate as I did. They were blackballed, and they were taken out of the exhibit. And the most famous one is The Kiss. Rodin's The Kiss shows this romantic, erotic embrace between a man and a woman, and they're in full-fledged kiss. I'd seen pictures of it before, and it was removed from the exhibit, ostensibly because it would offend the tender sensibilities of some members of the community. Well, the day after that announcement was made, I wrote a 2 or 3 paragraph letter. I sent it to the curator of the museum. And then I read the letter in my biology class. And I read it nearly every semester to every other class I ever taught at BYU. And explained why I thought that was an unfortunate decision. In part, I explained how often I had seen on the fingers of BYU students their choose the right rings. I'd just come back from a sabbatical leave in Boston, and I got to be the CTR teacher in primary. It was one of the great church experiences of my life. Come to BYU and we will help you to continue to choose the right. We'll teach you the difference between the truly wonderful and the trashy in art, and help you learn to be thoughtful about making the distinctions. And I wish The Kiss had been left in the exhibit. I ended my little letter by saying that on a lot of days I came home from my office at BYU. John, you've been in my office, and it's still as cluttered now as it was when you were around. Maybe some of the papers are still under the piles. And tired out, exhausted. A lot of the to-do list that I began with in the morning left undone. Come home, see my extraordinary wife, give her a kiss, and that helped to lift a little bit of life's drudgery. And I said to the students, if you ever have that feeling about somebody that you love, I recommend that, and you ought to pursue that kind of a kiss. Well, I have never felt intimidated. Maybe I've not always been wise about statements I've made to students on issues like this, but I'm glad I did that at BYU. Were I still there, I would continue to do the same. During my experience at BYU, in hindsight, the sort of golden years were those when Jeff Holland was the president of the university and Jay Baliff and Elliot Butler were the associates. Those men knew what the university should be like. And they articulated a hope for BYU. And I believe that we as a faculty bought in to their hopes and their aspirations. And they captured our loyalty. And we were trying to make the place better. In all ways, we were not in any way abandoning the spiritual roots of BYU. We were trying to help people in addition to committing to lifetimes of faithful Latter-day Saint activity, to teach people to make a difference in the world because of what they knew and how they could think and how they could solve problems. Some of that spirit didn't continue. I'm sad about that. I remember when Bruce Hafen was the provost of the university, he gave a talk in the fall opening meeting and said that he had made a presentation to the Board of Trustees that was monumental, that was going to give a wonderful new direction to BYU. But he didn't say what the presentation was about. I found out later that he had made a presentation in which he looked at universities that began through support of religious organizations. So that included many of the Ivy League schools, schools like Notre Dame, SMU, and others. And the presentation bemoaned the fact that these institutions in their current contemporary form had lost their religious moorings. They'd been secularized. And so we better watch out or BYU might follow down this unfortunate path. Well, if I would have had a chance to talk to Brother Hafen, I would say, Bruce, come walk around BYU. Let me show you what BYU is like. I don't see this. I don't think this is a threat. I think you find here committed Latter-day Saints who believe in this enterprise and are doing their very best. But what followed for several years then was a sort of dampening of the enthusiasm that I had felt earlier. While I greatly appreciate the efforts of Presidents Bateman and Samuelson in leading the university, and I can't possibly imagine the kinds of personal sacrifices that are involved in that kind of service, it would be my hope that in the future, BYU presidents would be chosen who are not necessarily general authorities of the church. I think it would become easier for that kind of a president to be a more visible advocate for the faculty, to be freer in having a vision of the liberal arts commitment of BYU, of bringing the concerns related to that to the board, and perhaps not feel constrained by either real or imagined concerns that the board might have about the administration of the university. I don't have a very good perspective anymore, given my retirement circumstance, but so I'm not in a position to speak for younger members of the faculty, but I remember those times under the administration of President Holland, and remember that I believe the university was making great and important strides. I'd like to see that same kind of spirit return.
May I ask you a few questions about that?
Go, John.
Some of my generation are trying to get up to speed on the history of, let's even say, your predecessors and maybe what led to the possibility of those years between 85 and 95. And we've learned about B.H. Roberts, for example, or Lowell Bennion or Leonard Arrington or Henry Eyring or Widstow or Talmadge. And then, you know, we learn of Eugene England and the dialogue years and then the Sunstone years. And some of us see that as a glorious, the term has been used, Camelot, of an emergence of strong thinkers or even a tradition of strong thinkers to balance out also a commitment to the gospel and to faith. And it seems like the 80s, as they built up to that mid-90s time, something really significant and almost special was going on, even though it clearly had its edges and it clearly had its dark side. But by the time I got to BYU, after my mission, and my audience will have heard about my mission experience, I was in a really dark place just because of disillusionment about what I expected mission leadership to be like and what it turned out to be. And so I came to BYU with a really dark place in my heart, trying to figure out how this could be the church that I was told it was, when such violent or frustrating things sometimes would happen organizationally. So I fell into your class where you would openly talk about evolution and in vitro fertilization and bioethical issues with fear and with courage. I think it was Vandegraaff who once said that a testimony should be like a jackhammer, not a soap bubble, that it should divide things asunder, not be guarded carefully in the palm for fear of it popping. And whether it was through your class or through your honors religion classes, where we talked about any and all of the most controversial and difficult topics, to my honors colloquium classes with Ted Lyon and Lynn England and Clayton White and others. It was almost like a Sunstone-like experience in the Mazur building. It was beautiful. And you guys left me with this hope that you could be faithful, committed, but also completely courageous and committed to the intellect. And so we sort of tried to carry that out in our efforts post-graduation. But we haven't been blind to what happened to the September 6th. We haven't been blind to some of the administration things that went on when Gail Houston and Cecilia Farr and David Knowlton and others were let go and academic freedom was in question at BYU. And, you know, if you look at the strain of courage as it relates, and courage and confidence as it relates to academics, and then contrast with, let's say, a strain of leadership within the church that is suspicious and fearful of science and the intellect. You know, the types of statements that the great enemies to the church are intellectuals and feminists and homosexuals. statements that not all things that are true are useful. And, you know, other types of efforts to clamp down and to marginalize thought. Some of us would look at sort of who won that battle, just like you could ask when Joseph Fielding Smith and B.H. Roberts went at each other in evolution. It kind of seems like Joseph Fielding Smith won that battle in the end, partly because he lived longer. If we look now at the church and where it is, and we ask ourselves, who's won that battle? It seems like it's not the courageous ones with confidence in the intellect and with science and with academics. And then when things like Proposition 8 happen, which we'll talk about later, it leaves a lot of us wondering why those things are allowed to happen and how can we retain confidence in leadership when leadership would allow something like that to happen to you or to others. And I don't say this to set you up for a difficult question. I don't say this to embarrass or to put anyone on the spot or even to denigrate anybody. But there's a lot of us just wondering sort of how do we retain confidence in those who guide the ship when things like September 6 or Cecilia Farr or Gail Houston or Bill Bradshaw or others continually seem to win the day. So I guess I don't know how you're, that's not really a question, but it's an expression. And, you know, I'm often eager to hear encouraging words to help some of us through some of these feelings that we're having.
Well, pretty heavy statement, John.
Am I too much hyperbole? Am I inaccurate?
No. I'm just saying you've brought a lot of things to think about, and they're profound. I don't have enough wisdom or understanding to provide much by way of satisfaction to the expression you've made. But I'll say a couple of words. I didn't think I could stand in front of students and advocate a certain perspective on the world or a certain scholastic approach to important issues if I couldn't be something of a role model for that kind of an approach that I was advocating. And at the time of my service at BYU, I found that there were a number of my colleagues who had a very similar outlook on their role as members of the faculty and who were most admirable men and women in the conduct of their personal lives and in their pursuit of solutions to difficult issues, some of which impacted church-related matters directly and some of which only indirectly. I never felt fearful that those investigations would not be in the best interests of my students. I was not so naive as to believe that some wouldn't be troubled, that some wouldn't call their parents or complain perhaps to a church authority. And some of those were directed at me, and they would come down the chain of authority from a parent somewhere in the church to the president of the university, and they'd get funneled down to me. but I was never told what I could say or what I could say. I was never subject to restraints in how I would conduct my class. I think that's probably because people had confidence in me as a committed Latter-day Saint. For me and my generation, for you and your generation, for the generation of my children and my grandchildren, I don't think we need to be afraid of ideas. There's one bit of advice that would help us a lot, and that is, in recognition of our profound ignorance about spiritual matters as well as secular matters, most of the time it's best to withhold judgment, and especially to learn how to treat with civility and sensitivity people who disagree with us. If we could learn to do that as a community of Latter-day Saints, we'd move a lot further in the direction I believe that the Savior would have us. That doesn't answer very much of what you brought up, John, but it's a modest expression of my optimism and my hope that we can learn to do better, and that will include being willing to listen to a diversity of points of view, not being afraid of open discussion of issues, and especially refraining from condemnation of other people.
And in your heart and mind, the church has nothing to fear, nothing significant to fear from science or research or thought. That
no. I don't see reasons to fear. I think in those explorations, our understanding is going to shift sometimes. Our understanding. But nothing in my opinion that leads us to abandon the centrality of the atonement of the Savior and our efforts to try to understand him better and follow his teachings.
I'm sold.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.